Session number 12989, Thomas Finnegan, Reel 3.
How nervous did you feel clearing the mines?
At the very beginning, quite nervous. We had a number of NCOs that had been posted into the unit from who saw service in North Africa and Italy, and they were sent home to reinforce the all the various units. So we had a number of NCOs who were battle acclimatized, if you would say the word, and they were very experienced indeed. I had a sergeant who was our reconnaissance sergeant who had an MM, and we looked upon him as almost like God. He knew everything, and he was very, very clever. And he taught us a lot, and we felt very, very confident, you know, in the minefields when he was around. We felt very confident indeed. It was a little bit more apprehensive when you started finding mines with booby traps, because then it took a longer time to lift a mine, because you had to work your way around the outside of the mine and also underneath the mine. And if it was rather hard ground, then it was you had to do that by your hands, sort of thing. You couldn't dig a mine out with a shovel. It had to be done by fingers, by your hands.
Why not a shovel?
Well, because if you lifted it with a shovel, then the igniter on the underneath part of a mine, which was attached to a peg that was underneath that, and that just pulled the igniter out, and then the mine would go up. You had different types of igniters that you used. You used a pull igniter, which was you lift a mine up and the igniter was pulled. Then you had another one, which was a pressure igniter, so that you could press down on a mine, and the igniter would get the mine up. And we used to use those more with our booby traps in buildings, treading on a doormat or, you know, a floorboard or anything like that, a pressure igniter.
But on D-Day, you were clearing a channel through the minefield.
Yes.
How deep was the minefield before you'd worked your way through it?
I should say that it was approximately, the minefield itself was approximately 40 yards wide, and it was the whole length of the beach, if you can see what I mean. The whole beach, it was in the dunes beyond the shoreline. And then the minefield, it just carried on for miles and miles and miles, you know, until you come to a small town, then it would go round that one, of course, and carry on.
How long did it take you to work your way right through the whole width of the minefield?
Well, not very long, not very long. I suppose we cleared a minefield in possibly half a day. And then the vehicles, well, the tanks would come ashore and de-waterproof. They would blow all their cowls off. You know, they had extended cowls for their exhausts. They were all metal. The turret, of course, the tank, it couldn't move its turret around because it had this waterproofing around the turret. That had to be blown away by electrically charged. With Cortex, they had a Cortex fuse, and that was all blown off before they could swivel their turrets then. But it was only a matter of minutes of coming ashore, going into the marshalling area, de-waterproofing, and off they go. It didn't take very long, didn't take very long at all.
But you didn't clear the whole minefield, you just cleared a path through it.
Eventually we cleared the whole lot. Because when the vehicles started to come ashore in earnest, then we were getting far, far, far more vehicles than we could possibly cope. So we had to clear the whole lot.
And it was the pioneers who were helping you?
Yeah, they were removing all the mines that had been lifted, taking them down the beach, further down the beach, and then we were blowing those up every half an hour, sort of thing, at about 20 at a time.
Did you feel it had all gone successfully on the first day?
You didn't really know what was going on at all. They probably knew more about it at home than we knew on the radio. Or you knew what was happening on your little sector. You didn't know what was happening a mile up the coast.
But on your little sector?
On our little sector, we were happy with what we were doing. We were very happy with what we were doing. And as a matter of fact, the beach that we actually cleared, and made safe and kept all the exits open, that was the beach that was selected for, let me say, in turn, there was His Majesty the King, there was Winston Churchill, there was General de Gaulle, also Field Marshal
Montgomery.
They all landed on our beach. So we felt that we had done a good job. We felt that we had made our beach quite safe. No doubt other sapper units in other beaches thought they had done exactly the same. But we thought, being that they landed on our beach, it was through our endeavour.
What was the name of your beach?
It was
Juno
Beach. It was just between Courcelles and Grey Samir.
Whilst you were doing the mine clearing, were you being shelled or?
Oh yes, we were being shelled, and occasionally the Luftwaffe would come over and drop a few bombs. It was rather surprising because although we had air superiority, we saw very little on the beach as regards fighters. We saw that our own bombers going over, and but we never saw any fighters. They were further inland. They were doing their job, sort of thing, further inland, which was probably a good thing because they were knocking out trains, I suppose, and vehicles and what have you.
How did you spend the first night in France?
Working all the time. I think we were about 2 or 3 days before we managed to get some sleep.
Just mine clearing the whole time?
Mine clearing and making more exits. We had to lay trackways down so that vehicles could use it because the soft sand. There was all sorts of labour kept rather busy. Mm.
Did you personally lay trackways?
Oh, we laid trackways, yes. We laid track, which is something like a Sommerfeld track, which is like a lot of wire on canvas. Or sacking, rather. It was all sacking. And the vehicles used to use that. The actual beach itself, when the tide went out, what happened then was that the tank landing craft used to come in and beach themselves and then wait till the tide went out before they opened their doors. And then the vehicles and the tanks, they could come out and drive on the hard sand.
So you must have been exhausted if you had gone without sleep for so long.
Well, we were on pills or tablets. They said that they were vitamins, but we couldn't dispute that. They might have been pills to keep us awake. I don't know.
Didn't you feel sleepy?
Not really. Not for the first couple of days.
Was that because you were so excited?
A lot of it was excitement, I suppose. Excitement and also fear. You get everyone has got fear. It's not, as I say, it's not everyone's cup of tea to be under fire. Everyone is afraid. A lot of people don't show it, that's all.
Do you think you showed it?
I don't think so. I don't think I did. for the simple reason that at a later date, the platoon officer used to take me on all his recces, and used to do nothing else but reconnaissance work.
So eventually they did give you a chance to sleep?
Oh yes, 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 because we stayed on the beach for approximately 3 weeks. Our main job then was over. Our job was to get the vehicles and the men ashore, and that was purely our main job. And once that was all over, then we were put on other tasks. After the beach, we went on training, as a matter of fact. They had a new idea as regards rafting. And we ended up on a canal trying out this new type of raft that they had knocked up. It was too late before the landings in Normandy, and they brought it down then. And what we used to do, our main job after that, was carrying out assaults on river assaults. Every time we come to a major river, then we were called forward to take the infantry across.
What did that involve for you?
That, it's storm boats taking the assault infantry across, and also these rafts. They were assembled in rather quick time, and they used to take the light vehicles and tanks onto the other side of the river.
Storm boats?
Storm boats. They're like little craft that you probably get about a dozen chaps kneeling down inside. Very shallow craft, but very, very fast. Very quite fast.
Where did you do this river crossing work?
On the various rivers that we came to, like the River Seine, the River Mars, and the Rhine. It was mostly major rivers. A lot of the rivers were very, very narrow, you know, because they didn't need those sort of things.
Do you remember the big breakout from the Normandy beachhead?
Yes, yes, I remember the big breakout. That was when I can always remember the Falaise Gap, when the Americans met up with the British, and I think that the Germans lost about 300,000 men in the Falaise Gap. And that was a smell that you will remember for the rest of your life. There was no doubt about it, that the stench and the stink of everywhere you looked, there was, you couldn't travel on the roads. You couldn't travel. The German transport, they had a lot of horse transport, was nose to tail. And if you travelled anywhere, it had to be the adjoining fields. You couldn't travel on the roads at all because of the dead. It was something that you just cannot describe.
So was it the animals or the men?
Animals, and mostly men, and the animals, of course. Mostly horse-drawn transport, you know, with probably two horses in each cart. And of course, on top of that, you've got the cows and the animals in the fields that were also killed by shrapnel and things like that. But it was one big area of stench, death.
How did you feel about it? Did you feel exultant or
no.
Pitiful or what?
Very pitiful, I think. You know, you didn't realise what we had actually done. You know, you thought to yourself, why didn't they give in?
Did you see German prisoners there?
Yes, we saw German prisoners. They used to come down every day. When we were on the beach, of course, mostly on the beach, they used to come down and go back into the landing craft back to England. They used to help when the tank landing craft came ashore and discharged all its vehicles and tanks. They used to immediately transform it into a hospital ship, and it went back with operating theatres, so that all the wounded, irrespective of whether they were British or German, they all went back on, and the heavily wounded were treated on the way back to England. They had these theatres there, and they were carrying operations, and they saved a lot of lives. The dressing station is what they call the field dressing stations. They wouldn't have any. If a chap even went with a boil on the back of his neck, he was sent straight home. There was no doubt about it. Get him out of the way. get him out of the way, send him home, have his treatment, and then come back. And that's what was happening. If a chap had toothache, they were doing that. Severe toothache. Although we had a dentist on the beach. We had a dentist who was kept rather busy.
So was there any malingering or self-inflicted wounds?
Not as I know of. Not as I know of. I suppose we... Overall, on the actual D-Day landings, we had about 20% casualties, I should imagine. That was with wounds, mostly. But they came back to us, apart from a few that had more serious wounds. And they came back so quick that you hadn't realised that they'd been away.
But did this sending home of people with minor medical complaints just apply to the sappers or also to the infantry?
Yes. You know, if they had sprained their wrist or something like that, they'd send them straight back. There was no hanging on to them because they were just in the way. It was quicker to send them back and then treat them and bring them back again. And what the German prisoners of war used to do, they used to carry all the... stretchers down, you know, onto the tank landing craft, carry all the stretchers and help the wounded, because it wasn't only their own people, it was ours as well.
Did they do it properly?
Yes, they did it very well, yeah. I suppose they were glad that they were out of it.
What did you see as you pushed up through France?
Pushed up through France, it was, some things were quite comical, other things were... I remember one occasion where we were going to take the part of the Highland Division over the Seine, and we had these special rafts that we were going to use, and we were told to go to a particular little village that was on the banks of the Seine, and we arrived there before it was taken. We didn't know that, of course, at that particular time, but it was before the infantry had arrived, and we were on these sledges. They were being pulled by armoured cars, and they were then pushed into the water and then assembled as a raft. And we arrived on the road making this awful noise, being driven on these sledges with the pontoons on the top. And we just waited in the village there, sitting on top, sitting on the side of the road, having a meal, when a German column of cyclists came past us. And they realised then that they were in British territory sort of thing, and they just gave themselves up. But they didn't know. But at the same time, we didn't know. About 2 hours later, the British infantry, it was the Highland Light Infantry, came up, and they were rather annoyed that we were in the village before they were. But that sort of thing used to happen.
This was on the banks of the Seine?
Banks of the Seine, yes.
So the cyclists didn't resist?
No, we stood up sort of thing, and they just stopped, and that was it. They put their arms down there, and we just made them sit on the side of the road in the middle of this village. They didn't know where they were. All we were given was a map reference of this little village, and we had to go there because that was where one of the crossings was going to be. But we arrived there too early. The infantry hadn't taken it, hadn't taken the village.
How many of the cyclists do you think there were?
20. Approximately 20 of them. Probably. But we had another case in Holland where we built a Class 9 bridge. Now, Class 9 bridge was one of the lightest bridges, and you couldn't take any heavy vehicles over it. But once you finished a bridge, you handed it over to the Royal Military Police, and they did the traffic control. And also you leave a sapper or two to carry any maintenance if there's any damage caused to the bridge. And this particular time, what happened was that we had handed over to the military police, and then we went on. And we went further up to the front, and which wasn't very, very far away. But about an hour after we left, a German convoy arrived with very heavy vehicles. And this Lance Corporal military police sort of thing held his hand up there and said, "I'm sorry, you can't come across." And the German officer in charge of the convoy, he realised then that he wasn't in his own part of the country. And of course he said to this large corporal, how far am I behind the lines? And this large corps was all about 40 miles. In actual fact, it was only a matter of four or five. So he just gave himself up there and then with the remainder of the convoy. But that's the sort of thing that could happen all over the place.
You haven't said anything about any contact you had with French civilians.
We had very little contact with French civilians for the simple reason that we were so busy. It's not like a headquarters of a unit. They used to pull in at a little town sort of thing and set up their headquarters or their company offices and all that sort of thing. The remainder of the unit would go out and carry out various tasks that we had to do. Bridge building, clearing mines, of course, and various other jobs, putting up water points. That was all carried out by the sappers, of course, you see. And troops had to be watered.
Where did you go to on your path through France and Belgium? Can you remember the names of the places?
Oh, I can't, no, no. It was so... When we got over the Seine, it was a matter of just bash on, and that was it. We just bashed on, sort of thing, right up into Holland.
So you didn't go through any big places like Brussels?
No, no, no. We went through Eindhoven in Holland. We went through Eindhoven when the American paratroopers were landing, and then but we couldn't reach the Mars because of the Arnhem because the roads were so chock-a-block that we just couldn't get our bridging supplies up. If we could have got them up, it would have been a different thing altogether. We felt that we let them down, but we just couldn't get on the roads. The roads were just nose to tail with vehicles.
Were you still with the Canadians by this
point? No. We left the Canadians at the beach. Our job was to get them ashore, and that was it. Once they were ashore, that was our job finished.
Who did you transfer to a new division?
No, we weren't divisional troops at all. We were just called upon to do any particular task that was required until we come to a major river sort of thing. Then we did, we supported the Highland Division, and we supported up in Holland, we supported the Guards Armoured Division.
Was there any particular division which impressed you more than the others?
No, not really. We thought that the guards overdid it slightly. They used to stop for tea, and the batman used to lay out the tablecloth sort of thing. It was almost like a mess night. Where our own officers, would sit down with us, the guards officers were completely different. They would sit down on their own.
And the Highland Division?
The Highland Division, we were only with them for a matter of a few hours, because once we got them over the side of the river, that was our job finished again.
Once that winter came up after Arnhem, where were you then in the Netherlands?
We built, it was a very, very cold winter. I can always remember that. And Christmas, there was the breakthrough at the Battle of the Bulge, when the... But they brought over the airborne, the 6th Airborne again, and troops were diverted because what the Germans' intention was to take Antwerp, but because they were stopped. But what we had to do, we had to build a gunnery range for the Royal Artillery. Why? I don't know. I think it was leading up to the Rhine crossing, and they were going to, to practice on this gunnery range, and we had to build this range. It was built of timber, small saplings, the road was, but it was very, very cold. It was ice everywhere. We had to dig through the ice like a permafrost, about a foot deep.
So a gunnery range consists of a wooden road?
Well, there was just a matter of open, it was right on the border of Belgium and Holland. And we built this road so that they could use it to bring their vehicles and guns up. But whether they used it or not, I don't know. As soon as the job was finished, then we just carried on. By that time, we were preparing to cross the Rhine. And of course, that was done under, when they were bringing up supplies and reinforcements, that was all done under a smoke screen during the day.
Did you take part in that?
Yes, yes.
Whereabouts?
A place between Zanton and Rees.